following audio is from Fathom Church in Littleton, Colorado. More information about Fathom can be found at fathomchurch.org.
Thank you, Chris. Like he said, my name is Landon, and I am the pastoral intern. Hopefully, I will be one of the pastoral interns at some point, but for now, I'm the only one. A lot of responsibility. Chris keeps shoving a lot of stuff on me and saying, hey, do this, do this. No, I'm just kidding. It's not that bad. I've met some of you, and it's been a pleasure to meet some of you, and I appreciate you coming up and introducing yourself, but there are some of you who I haven't met, and I do hope to meet you at some point soon, maybe at the luncheon afterwards. That would be great. Kind of like we planned for that. I don't know what that was, but I'm looking forward to meeting those of you who I haven't met, and learning your names and learning a little bit more about you. So let's get started in our examination of the Word today. I want to ask you a couple of questions first. Do you know what it's like to be a slave? Do you know what it's like to live a life that you don't really have any control over? That you don't get to decide when you get up and where you go or what you do, but someone else tells you what to do. Someone else forces you to do those things. Someone else has control and power and authority over you in your life. Now, my guess is most of us don't really know what that's like. Most of us have, we live in the U.S., we live in a place where that's not okay, where business owners and business practices don't do that, typically. And so what we know about slavery is either through history books or it's through stories and experiences that we've had with people outside of the U.S. And I'd like to tell you about a ministry that I got the opportunity of engaging with that deals with slaves and deals with slavery. I met a man, his name is Jonathan, and Jonathan lives in Bangalore, India. And his ministry is called Bangalore City Mission. And what they do is they work with a specific population of people who are slaves. They work with people who work in granite mines. And these aren't happy, exciting, enjoyable places to work. They don't get workers' comp. They don't have like good benefits and life insurance. It's hard. It's difficult. These people live in shanty towns, and they've got probably a 10 to 15 to 20 foot square house that they live in with their family. Dirt floor. There's no windows. There's no holes in the roof. And so whenever they cook over their small fire, the smoke just kind of fills up the room. And then whenever they step out on the street, it's dirt paths. It's all muddy. Oftentimes there's open sewage just running through the streets. Not a great existence. And then they have to go to work, and at these quarries, it's all rock, and so the sun just beats down on them and on the rock, and the heat just rises and rises. So if it's 100 degrees outside, it's going to be 120, 125 degrees. There's little water. It's not clean. They get dehydrated. They're using dynamite to blast rock, and then they're using sledgehammers to break rock. And they can't get out of this cycle. They can't escape from it. A lot of them have taken out loans from the quarry owners just to buy a day's worth of rice. And they are called loans, but typically they're not actually loans. They keep them stuck. They keep them in place. And I wonder if sometimes we might know what it's like to be a slave. Maybe not in the physical sense, maybe not in terms of not being able to go places we want to or talk to whoever we want to, but maybe sometimes we feel like we're a slave to sin. Whether it's a specific sin that keeps coming up or whether it's multiple sins that come different weeks, different times. We feel like we can't get away. There's no escape. There's no hope. Just like the people in India at these quarries have no hope to leave, to get out for a better life. Sometimes we lose hope that we can have a better life. So as we're in Genesis 4 today, we're going to talk a little bit about what it looks like to be a slave to sin. We're going to talk a little bit about what it looks like to have no hope. If you'll turn with me to Genesis 4, verses 1 to 16, that's going to be our text for today. Also, these Fathom cards make really good Bible marks, bookmarks. It's helpful. And then, as a good pastor, I always carry my Bible around, so I can just pull this out and hand people cards. I'm just kidding. I don't do that. But let's look at Genesis 4. The story of Cain and Abel, it's not really actually about Abel at all. It's just about Cain. Let's start reading in verse 1. Verses 1 to 7. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the first of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. We see this transition from the garden. Last week we talked about, the last 2 weeks, Chris talked about the fall. He talked about the actual fall, and then he talked about the effects of the fall. And at the end of the chapter, we see the flaming sword of the cherubim as God drives Adam and Eve out of the garden. And then this is what happens next. We hear Adam and Eve had children. They're living outside of the garden, and they have children. Cain and Abel. Cain is a worker of the ground, and Abel's he's a keeper of the sheep. The text isn't saying that either one is more important, it's just a description of what's going on. But in this description, we move on and we see that Cain and Abel recognize that they are not the ones responsible for all this growth that's happening. They are not the ones that gets to build up and create fruits of the ground and lambs or goats. It's God that's blessing them. It's God that's giving them gifts. And so they give him an offering out of gratitude, out of recognition that it's from you that these things are coming. But God doesn't look with favor. Literally, it says God does not gaze upon the offering of Cain, but he gazes upon the offering of Abel. And we read this text and we go, why? Why is this happening? And oftentimes it can be confusing because it doesn't say why God didn't accept Cain's offering. The text doesn't say. We don't know for sure. But what it does tell us is that Cain offered something from the ground, from the fruits of his labor, and Abel offered something of the firstborn of his flock and the fat portions. Abel offered the very first lamb that was born to him as he cared for his sheep, and he offered the best portions of that lamb. He gave the very best of the very first. And yet Cain, the text doesn't say, did that. He still gave an offering to God. He still acknowledged that God was in control, he was sovereign, he was taking care of him, but he didn't offer the first fruits, it appears in the text. And so there seems to be something going on in Cain's heart. There seems to be something about Cain's attitude that says, I'm going to give you something, but I'm not going to give you the very best. I'm going to give you something, but it's not going to be the first. And this puts him in a precarious position, right? It puts him at a point where he's angry. His face has fallen. I think of a little kid who like has done something wrong and mom and dad calls him out and they go, yeah, that was me. I did that. Cain gets angry and he goes, why? Why was that not something? Why did you refuse to accept that? Why did you look at me and look away and not accept that offering? It puts him in a precarious position. And this is where God speaks. This is where we hear what God says to Cain. He gives Cain an option to opt out. He gives Cain a chance to say, I'm not going to engage in sin. Because what the text is telling us in verse 7 says, if you do well, will you not be accepted? Will there not be a lifting up of your face? Will there not be a moment of joy saying, yes? Yeah, thank God, I praise you. But if you do not do well, sin is crouching at your door. Sin is ready to rule over you and to master you, but you mustn't let it do it. It's setting two options before Cain and saying, you're in this place, you're angry, your face has fallen, you can choose to do well, or you can choose to not do well. And he's telling Cain that that's coming. He's got an option. He's got a choice. He can choose to opt out of this sin. And yet, he's not sure about what's going to happen. He's not sure about what Cain is going to do. A choice to sin comes with a chance to opt out. Choice to sin comes with a chance to opt out. So when we're confronted with a situation where we might have an opportunity to sin or a chance to sin, not like it's a good thing, maybe it's a bad situation. We have that choice. We have an option. Maybe it's you're having a really rough day. Maybe your kids are screaming, and when I was growing up, I always antagonized my brother, and so I made life really rough on my mom. God bless her heart, gosh. But maybe it's just the last straw, and you want to get upset, and you want to yell, and you want to scream and say, all right, you over here, you over there, that's it. No more. And maybe you could say something that you don't want to. Maybe you could say something hurtful. Maybe you could say something that really hits your kid at the core. Before you get to that point, you have a chance. You have an option. You can say, I don't want to engage my kids like that. I want to discipline them, to say this is not right, but I want to do it well. Maybe if you're not married and you're dating somebody, maybe it's a better idea not to spend all evening at their house alone watching a movie on the couch. Maybe it's better to take a walk, spend an evening outside, enjoy each other, in the park. I love taking walks. Are great. Just spending some time outside. Colorado's awesome, so why would you not want to take walks? That's me. But you have a choice. There's an option. Maybe in your job there are chances for, there are ethical situations that come up. Maybe you're an accountant and how you categorize something could look poorly on the company's fiscal review. Or maybe you're asked to do something that kind of is in line with industry standards, but kind of isn't. It's kind of cutting a corner. A little shaky. Maybe you've been there. Maybe that could happen. What are you going to do when that situation comes? What are you going to do whenever you're confronted with that? Are you going to wait until that situation and then make the decision? Or are you going to think through that and say, well, if that happens, This is how I'm going to respond. This is how I'm going to act. Maybe you've suffered a job loss or a loss of a friend or a family member or someone very close to you. And there's grief and hurt and pain. And you could choose to rely on something, to depend on something, to use something to make yourself feel better that isn't right. You could turn to alcohol. You could turn to drugs. You could turn to, my favorite one was video games in college, and just play video games on and on and on and on. But it's not right. God gives us a chance to opt out when we're confronted with sin. And he expects us to choose that. But oftentimes, we don't. Oftentimes, we don't. And whenever we have that chance, sometimes we don't follow through, and we do get sucked in. And so, what happens then? What happens whenever we don't choose rightly? What happens whenever we get sucked in? Let's continue on and see what Genesis has to say about that. Verse 8. Cain spoke to Abel, his brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" He said, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground, and now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it shall no longer yield to you its strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." So Cain gets sucked in. He chooses not to avoid that temptation, not to avoid his anger, not to deal well with his anger and his disappointment, but he gets sucked in. A choice to sin spirals out of control. Oftentimes, whenever we make that initial decision, it keeps going. It starts with one thing, but it keeps going. And that could be one specific sin, or it could be just a lot of them. Oh, I've already done this one. I may as well go do this one. Oh, I've already started on this path. I may as well just keep going. There's no use resisting. I don't have any choice in the matter. Now, to heck with it. And we see that in the text, too. Chapter 4 builds on chapter 3, and there's a lot of parallels that we can see. In verse 6 of chapter 3, we see that Adam and Eve disobey God. They take the fruit and they eat of it. They rebel against what God had said and they disobey. But in chapter 4, in verse 8, we see what does Cain do? He doesn't just disobey. He doesn't just not listen to what God says. He commits murder. And not just any murder, but he murders his own brother. The person in the social context of this world that is supposed to be the closest, you're supposed to trust family, you defend family, you're not supposed to have to worry about your brother killing you. And we see sin going from disobedience and expanding to murder. We see sin going from not listening to a violation of the relationship that is supposed to be most sacred amongst other humans on earth. Then in verses 9 to 13 of chapter 3, we see Adam and Eve respond by saying, I'm gonna justify myself. It wasn't my fault, it was the woman. She made me do it. It wasn't my fault, it was the serpent. He was the one who convinced me to do it. They're shifting the blame, like Chris said last week. And yet, when we get to chapter 4, Cain no longer just shifts the blame. He lies. I don't know where he's at. And then he gets a little bit of an attitude, right? I don't know where he's at. Am I supposed to be the one taking care of him? I thought that was your job, God. What, are you falling asleep on the job? Then that's your fault you don't know where he's at. There's an amplification of how people are responding whenever sin becomes a part of their life. And then whenever we get to the punishment, verse 17 of chapter 3 says that the ground was cursed, and Adam working it would cause toil and labor. But then whenever we get to chapter 4, Cain himself is subject to a curse. Cain himself receives the punishment. Cain himself suffers. And as we read this narrative from chapter 3 and then chapter 4 grows on it, next week we're going to see chapter 5 grows even more on that. And then it culminates in chapter 6 in Genesis with the flood, where humanity is described as being utterly corrupted. There is no good left in the world. Since Adam and Eve began this descent, it just continues sliding down and down. And God, until God can't take it anymore and has to do something about it. Once we're caught by the spiral of sin, it's hard to escape its clutches. Once we get so engrossed, so caught up, so victimized, so entrenched in that cycle of sin, it's hard to get out. It's hard to leave. I grew up in Elkhart, Indiana, and one of the many things that is great, and I'm saying that with just a tinge of sarcasm, Elkhart County actually has the second largest county fair in the United States. We don't have anything else in Elkhart County, but we've got the fair. And they have all the horses and the cattle and the tractor pull and lots of country music concerts and things like that. But one of the things that they bring in the carnival, and so there's all these carnival rides. And usually, there's a free day, and so you kind of go out and you ride the tilt-a-whirl, and you go on, I don't even remember what all of them are called, but you go on the one that like flips you upside down and then stops and then goes, or the circle that just goes in a loop. I don't get some of those. But one of the rides that they have was like the Starship 2000, right? And it's supposed to be fun. You're supposed to enjoy this. And you get on, and you strap yourself in, and then it spins in a circle really fast, and you can't move. And it's great, until the ride breaks, and it can't stop. And you can't get off. And then you're just stuck there. You keep going, and going, and you're going. And then they finally, get it to stop, and you get off, and you lose all the cotton candy that you just ate, an hour ago. And all those deep-fried Snickers bars that are so awesome. Does anyone have that? I've never had. Was it any good? Yes? Okay, maybe I'll have to try it. But you get stuck. And it's no fun anymore. And yet you can't get out. You're stuck in this spiral on this ride. And it's like that sometimes whenever we get stuck in the spiral of sin. And so I don't know what it is for you. Maybe it's the same recurring sin. Maybe you feel like you have no power over this sin, and there's no ability, there's no hope of being able to resist it, there's no thought of actually being able to get out of this sin. Maybe you just keep responding in different ways. Maybe one week it's this sin. Maybe the next week it's this sin. But whatever it is, you can't seem to shake it. You can't seem to get out of that rut. You can't seem to make it right. And that can be frustrating. That can be disheartening. Not a lot of hope in that. We don't want to be in this cycle. If we could have anything we wanted, we would be out of it. We would have no problem with this. We would be fine. We would be living well, living rightly. Our relationship with God would be great. Our relationship with other people would be great. And yet we can't seem to shake it. And whenever we get sucked into that cycle, It does something. It pushes us away. It pushes us away from other people, and it pushes us away from God. Let's take a look at chapter 4 again. Verse 13. Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." Then the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. We see how Cain responds. When confronted with a choice to sin, it sucks us into isolation. When confronted with a choice to sin, we get driven. Sometimes our punishment pushes us into isolation. We no longer are connected with people. We no longer feel connected to God. We no longer sense that we are okay. God's punishment for Cain is to curse the ground that he works. He's taking away Cain's very livelihood. How Cain gets food and provides for his family is through working the ground. And God curses him and takes it away. And so he can no longer stay in one place. He can no longer live with his family and the rest of the society, but he has to move. He has to leave. Cain's reaction is this is too much. This is too much for me. You're being too hard on me. I can't handle this. You're driving me away from you. You're driving me away from my family. You're driving me away from the very people that connect us and protect us and provide a solid foundation for existence. And like we saw last week, in the midst of Adam and Eve's punishment, we again see God giving grace to those he punishes. We again see God giving grace to Cain. He says, "I will put a mark on you so that the people that you're driven away from, the people that who view you as a murderer and see it as just to kill you, I will put a mark on you so they won't do that. I will put a mark on you so that you will continue to live, and yet you will continue to live in your punishment. You will continue to suffer the consequences of your actions." Even in the midst of that, there is grace. Even in the midst of the punishment, there is grace. And yet it pushes Cain further away. The text ends by saying, "And Cain moved further east of Eden." He moved further away from God's divine presence as symbolized by the Garden of Eden. He moved further away even from where his family was. He continued to go east. Is this east? No, this is east. He continued to go east, away from everything, everyone that he knew. Further and further and further. And he settled where? In the land of Nod, which means the land of wandering. The land of placelessness. Placelessness. The land where no one belongs. That's what this is symbolizing here. So Cain has no support, and he no longer belongs. And he's living in isolation, east of Eden, away from the presence of God. Sounds hard. Sounds painful. Sounds broken. Sounds hopeless. Sounds lonely. And that's where this story leaves us. Cain and Abel leaves us here at the depths of depravity, at the depths of utter corruption, at the depths of sin, at the bottom of that cycle of sin that Cain fell into, that he didn't resist, but he fell into And now he's alone. He's isolated. He has no connections with people. Shame is a powerful motivator. Whenever we suffer shame, we don't want to engage with people. We don't want to connect with people. We don't want to connect with God. We don't want to confess anything to him or to others. Shame drives us away. Our face falls and we wander. We leave. We're driven away. And oftentimes at the bottom of that cycle of sin, whenever we get sucked in, we begin to feel shameful and we leave. We disconnect ourselves or we're driven away from other people who are the very people who can offer support or who are the very people who can offer community, who are the very people who can offer connection for us, forgiveness and grace. We're driven away from God. We think, oh, God doesn't want to have anything to do with me. I can't bear to be in the presence of God, or I can't bear to think that he would forgive me for the very things that I have done. He knows how black my heart is. He knows how painful my heart is. He knows how far I've wandered, how far I've been driven away. He knows how disobedient I am. He can't possibly forgive me and give me grace. And that's where we find ourselves. College was a great time for me. There was a lot of wonderful things that happened. Got to play on the baseball team, which was amazing. Made some fantastic friends. Met some fantastic people. But college was also a dark time for me. And there were a number of things that played into that. But one of them was I wanted to be independent. I wanted to do it all on my own. I wanted to do it by myself. I didn't want to connect with anyone. I didn't want to have to rely on anyone else. And that was, I would say that was very, the attitude that I had in taking that position was pretty sinful. I didn't want to have to rely on God for anything. I wanted to figure out what I was doing, where I was going, who I was doing things with, what career I was doing, all of that I was going to do to make me happy and get me on the right track. And so, through a number of choices, a number of different circumstances, I got isolated. That drive to be so independent disconnected me from people who cared about me, friends who cared about me, disconnected me from God in a lot of ways. So I was alone. I had friends, I had people who I hung out with, but I don't know that they really knew me. Not because they didn't want to, but because I didn't want them to really know me. I was scared of who I was, and I was scared that they wouldn't like who I was. So I lived in isolation. I lived in this place of darkness. Place of disconnection. And it deepens. That sense of isolation deepens when we're caught in the clutches of sin. Whenever we're so grasped by that sin that we can't get away, it sucks us further and further and further in. And this is the end of our story. That's all that Cain and Abel says. There's not hope provided here for Cain. There's not hope provided for him. And it ends in chapter 6 with Noah and the flood. And every man did as he saw fit in his own eyes. Every person decided what they wanted to do, and they didn't care who told them they couldn't or shouldn't, or if it was better for them, they did it anyway. But where does hope come in? Where does hope enter the story? If we go back to the story about the slaves in India, my friend Jonathan, through Bangalore City Mission, provides hope to those people. He provides a way for them to leave that cycle. He provides education for the kids, almost free. He raises a lot of support for these kids, and they get to go and learn. They get to go learn how to use computers. They learn how to teach. They learn how to do a number of things so that they can support themselves, that they can leave this cycle of slavery. He provides, Jonathan provides opportunities for microloans, and women in the community can take out a loan with other women in the community, and they can buy a goat and make cheese and sell it. They can learn, they can buy material and sew things and make clothes and sell it. He's providing a way of hope for these people to get out of that situation. And for us, we have hope in the gospel. When we're confronted with a situation to sin, we have a chance to opt out. We have a choice to say, I don't want to have anything to do with that. But oftentimes we get sucked into this cycle. We get caught in the clutches of sin, and we can't get out. It keeps spiraling. It keeps deepening. And it drives us further and further into isolation, away from God and away from other people who care for us. And yet, the gospel gives hope. The gospel gives freedom. Through the gospel, we can find hope, satisfaction in God and in other people. It's recorded in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in the gospels that Christ came. He was on this earth. He lived as you and I live on this earth. He suffered. He died. He rose again. And it is that story that is the gospel. It's that story that says, on that cross, Christ died for our sins. Christ died to say, your sin no longer defines who you are. Your sin no longer is the epitome of who you are as a human being. But now who you are as a human being is defined through Jesus Christ. You are now a son of God. You are now a daughter of God. That is the gospel. It's saying that your sin has been forgiven through Christ's actions on the cross. You have been redeemed. You have been reconciled to God. And now you can enter into relationship with Him. And not only that, Christ died to defeat sin. Christ died to defeat the devil. He died so that He no longer has power over our life. He no longer can suck us in to that cycle of sin. He no longer can say, you are going to get caught in the clutches of sin. I'm going to grab onto you and never let go. Through Christ, we have the freedom to release the grasp of sin, to live a life of freedom, to live a life of connection with God, to live a life of connection with others, to live as sons and daughters of Christ. To live as sons and daughters of the living God, the creator of the entire universe, the God, the divine being who sent His Son to connect with us in a way that we never could on our own, of our own strength. It is through this story of redemption and reconciliation and forgiveness and freedom that we can connect with God. We no longer have to be stuck in the clutches of sin. We no longer have to be defined by our sin, by the sin in our lives. We are defined by our status as children of God. For some of you, this might be a reminder. For some of you, this might be a life that you are living now, and your life is full of hope. For some of you, this might need to be a reminder that this is who you are. That you are in relationship with Jesus Christ. That you are in relationship with God. And that through Him you have forgiveness. Through Him you have reconciliation. Through Him you have freedom. Maybe some of you don't know what that's like. Don't know what that story means. Don't know what it, the implications that it has for you as far as your own life and your own relationship with God. Maybe you're not even sure who God is or if he really exists. But if today you want to learn a little bit more about that, please connect with Chris or I after service or send us an email. We would love to get together with you and talk with you about what this means, about what it could mean for you in your life, about the freedom that you can have. This is the story of the gospel. This is the story of freedom from the clutches of sin. Would you pray with me? Lord Jesus, we come to you in hope. We come to you knowing that the relationship that we have with you or that we can have with you can define us as sons and daughters of you. We're grateful for that hope. We're grateful for that freedom. And yet we come and we recognize that sin sometimes plays a large part in our lives. Sin can suck us in. It can derail us. And we confess that, God. We confess that we're prone to wander. We're prone to leave. We're prone to avoid you, thinking that you can't forgive. And yet we know the truth of your word. We see how devastating sin can be, and yet we see how life-giving and freeing the gospel can be. God, I pray as we as a church, as I as a person go from this place, that we would be continually reminded of this freedom. We would be continually reminded that this is who we are, children of God. It's in your name we pray. Amen.